Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk about the economy and U.S. economic policy, how those have treated millions of Americans who we call the working poor. The unemployment rate, as we know, has declined to very low levels in recent times, although in more recent times it's climbing again. But what the unemployment rate can't measure is the number of people working full-time who remain in poverty, a number which has not declined. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk about why that is the case, about what it really takes for working people to make a living wage, and what might be done to improve the wages of all working Americans. Our guest is commentator and author Holly Sklar. She is the director of Media Vision, a strategic research and communications firm in Boston, and she's authored or co-authored a number of books on economic and political affairs, including Shifting Fortunes, The Perils of the Growing American Wealth Gap, and Chaos or Community, Seeking Solutions, Not Scapegoats for Bad Economics. Holly Sklar is also the co-author of a book we'll be drawing from during this hour. It is entitled Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us, recently published by the Ms. Foundation for Women. In the book, Ms. Sklar and her co-authors describe the inadequacies of policies to date in ensuring economic growth and security for those at the bottom of the wage scale, and what kind of measures might make a difference. As we talk with Holly Sklar about that during this hour, you are invited into the conversation. Your questions and comments on the topic are welcome. All you have to do is call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the state of Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where we reach, 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-WILL. And toll-free 800-222-WILL. Holly Sklar, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks
for being here.
Well, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let's begin by talking about who are the working poor.
Well, the working poor, a lot of people have this idea that the working poor are mostly teenagers, which isn't true at all. Only a minority of the working poor are teenagers. Most are adults. The majority of minimum wage workers are adults, and most of those adults are women, but there are many men as well. And the situation that we're looking at is people in particular who are working full-time, working hard all year round, full-time, but can't make ends meet, can't even meet their basic needs, such as paying the rent, buying health care, buying food, and so on. And if you think about categories of people, you can think about how we have this situation where we have healthcare aides who can't afford health insurance. We have childcare workers who are working hard at their jobs who cannot even think about saving for their own children's education because they don't make enough money. We have workers in the food industry who have to turn themselves to food banks to feed their families. Again, people who are working hard but not making enough to meet their basic needs.
I think it's important to emphasize this because when we talk about the minimum wage, I mean, I hear rhetoric when the discussion is around raising the minimum wage that, well, look, we're just talking about teenagers earning some extra money anyway. These people are not supporting themselves. But indeed, what you're saying is that there are many people, in fact, the majority of people earning the minimum wage are not teenagers. They're people who are trying to support families and so forth.
Well, they're certainly the majority are not teenagers, and they're adults. And the other thing that to keep in mind is that we're not talking about, you know, 15 and 16 year olds for the most part when we're talking about teenagers. Where sometimes even within those minimum wage workers who are teenagers, we're talking about people who may be 18, 19 years old, out of high school, graduated from high school, and already on their own and having to earn a living.
You write that the minimum wage has become a poverty wage instead of an anti-poverty wage.
That's right. The minimum wage was first established way back in the late 1930s, and the principle was you should get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. Somebody should pay you enough to be able to meet your basic needs. And the minimum wage was established at that time nationally so that we would have a national floor under which nobody would go, whether you lived in Illinois or Indiana or New York or California or wherever you were, there would be this national floor. And what we've had a situation, we've got, Americans still believe, if you look at the polls, most Americans believe that a job should keep you out of poverty and not keep you in it. But the minimum wage over the last number of decades has gone in a different direction. back in 1968, when the minimum wage reached its peak, if you look back to then, we have had a drop of 35% since then, if you adjust for the cost of living, if you adjust for inflation. If you say, what would the minimum wage have to be today to just be what it was back in 1968, forget any kind of increase, just adjusting for inflation, what would it have to be? It would have to be over $8 an hour today. And today's minimum wage, just to make sure everybody realizes, it is $5.15 an hour. That is all. And that $5.15 an hour translates, if you take it over a year, working full time, you'll be earning just $10,700 a year. So that minimum really isn't a minimum. It's a poverty wage in which people are forced to do these terrible juggling acts all the time, in which they can't, for example, afford health insurance. And so they go without health insurance, or they get to the end of the month and they start skipping meals because they don't have enough to be able to both buy food and pay the rent. These are choices that people make that they shouldn't have to make if they're working. And let me just focus on health insurance for a minute, because it's a really terrible juggling act when you say to people, you're going to be working full time, you're going to be working hard, but here you go, you're going to be earning so little you can't afford health insurance. Well, health insurance, lack of it, has a real consequence. Studies show that health insurance is associated, if you don't have it, it's associated with a 25% higher risk of death. It has this real consequence. People without health insurance have a higher rate of death, higher risk of death. And this inadequate health insurance is one of the reasons that the United States ranks number one in the world in wealth, but only number 32 when it comes to child mortality, that is the number of children dying per capita under the age of five. And lack of health insurance is one of the main reasons why we have such a high child mortality rate. Even though we're a very wealthy country, we've got nearly 40 million Americans who have no health insurance, including 8 million children. And certainly the minimum wage should be set high enough so that people can have meet their basic needs, food, health care, housing, the most basic needs.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about those areas, certainly, as we go through this hour. You know, backing up to the establishment of the minimum wage, this was part of the New Deal, essentially. And it was essentially established with the phrase, a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. Was that part of the rhetoric?
That was part of the rhetoric. Roosevelt and others used that language. The idea was, if you're going to run a business, there are certain things that you have to be responsible for, and one of them is you have to pay workers some level of a decent wage, at least a minimum wage. And, you know, today we expect people, you can't do anything when you open up a business. You can't just do whatever you want. You're supposed to not be able to just dump, you know, toxic waste in the river, even though that might be cheaper for you in the short run to dump your toxic waste in the river. Well, of course, we have all sorts of laws that are supposed to enforce to say you can't do that, whether it's cheaper or not. There are other kinds of regulations we have, and one of them has to do with we set this floor, this minimum wage floor, that you can't just hire anybody at whatever you want. You have to at least pay them some minimally decent level. And unfortunately, the government has allowed that level to drop and drop and drop, so that every time the minimum wage goes up a little bit, it doesn't make up for the ground that's been lost in between. And so we have this really outrageous situation where since 1968, workers have gotten much more productive. We've got worker productivity going up over 70% since 1968, adjusted for inflation. We've got domestic corporate profits going up about 64%, adjusting for inflation. And we've got the minimum wage in that same period dropping 35%, even though worker productivity has gone up and so on. So there's been this real kind of shift in the rewards of rising worker productivity, rising profit, and so on. Workers are getting less of their fair share of those rewards of their work. And this has an impact on workers up the wage scale as well, because we have seen average wages stagnate. Today the average worker makes less still than the worker did in 19, their counterpart worker did in 1973 during the Nixon administration, which is, you know, for most people something far back in history that many people weren't even alive for. And I think, you know, can you imagine asking a worker in the 1960s or 70s, you know, what will you be making, or what would your counterpart be making far off in the future there in the year 2001, which seemed like this, you know, fantastic world. We would have this futuristic world and so on. And to tell them that in that future, workers will be making a third less, minimum wage workers will be making a third less than they do today, I think workers in the 60s and 70s would just think you are crazy.
You make the argument that when workers are not paid a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, they are not just underpaid, they are subsidizing employers, stockholders, consumers.
That's absolutely right. They're subsidizing them with their work because they're not getting the fair share. And so let's look at the CEO worker pay gap, because that's one of the main ways you can illustrate this point. We had this whole period where CEO pay, corporate executive pay went up, but wages went down, as did productivity go up, wages go down, profits go up, wages went down. So back in 1980, the CEO, the average CEO at a major corporation, as measured not by me but by Business Week magazine, made 45 times the pay of average workers, 45 times the pay of average workers. And in 2000, CEOs made 458 times as much as average workers. That is a real shift in how the pie there was distributed. And so in 1980, CEOs are making 45 times the pay of average workers. In the year 2000, the gap has widened 10 times wider, and they're making 458 times as much as average workers.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. I'll do that, but let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with Holly Sklar. She's co-author of the book that is the subject for our conversation. The book is entitled Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies at Work for All of Us, and recently published by the Ms. Foundation for Women. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. Holly, I've enjoyed your journalism for some time.
Thank you.
Three basic points I guess I'd like to make. I think back over my work history, it seems like probably the most physically demanding and often most stressful jobs, and this, you know, relates to lack of health care too, I've had have been actually the minimum wage jobs that I had early on. And also, it seems like I remember reading somewhere that in like Scandinavia, Sweden, Norway, places like that, where they have made a real effort to try to sort of shorten the gap between the lowest paid and the highest paid, that they've had an overall benefit to the economy. It's been more of a, you know, it's operated more even and good pace for the economy as a whole in the country rather than having sharp swings up and down. And I guess the third thing I'd like to say is that I think that it would really help a lot if somehow we could tie the minimum wage to a multiple of congressional salaries, so that anytime Congress wanted a raise, that they'd have to raise it for everybody at the bottom. And also, I, you know, that would be one way, because there's almost nothing else, it seems like, that would keep the interest of the poor in the minds of our political officials.
Well, let me start with your last point, because it's an excellent idea, and it's funny because I actually wrote an op-ed piece a number of years ago where I was talking exactly about that and proposed that they link the minimum wage to congressional pay, and for precisely the reasons that you mentioned. And I don't have the figures right in my head, but it's something like minimum wage used to be about 8 times lower than congressional pay, and then it rose to something like 15 times higher congressional pay than the minimum wage. And the idea of linkage, I think, is really, really an excellent one.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if you could do that with just, you know, like CEOs as well, but that's probably about to be even harder to pull off. But one thing I think they should really do is, you know, fine, you can pay your CEOs anything you want, but you're going to have to pay taxes on anything over, say, $2 million that you pay them now. You know, now they can just write the whole thing off. They pay them $20 million or $30 million, you know, they can take that as a business expense and not have to pay any taxes on it.
Yeah, this is the other outrageous component to the CEO pay issue, because taxpayers actually subsidize outrageous CEO pay. And, you know, what's interesting about CEO pay is that this is an issue that has gotten wide attention, including from the bastions of the business press, you know, the Wall Street Journal, Business Week magazine, Fortune magazine, and so on. They have put, you know, CEO, Wall Street Journal looks at CEO pay every year, and they had a headline at one point, which was CEO pay, pay for non-performance, or executive pay, pay for non-performance. Business Week had a cover story a few years ago, which was CEO pay out of control. Fortune magazine called it the great CEO pay heist. And so it is well known that a lot of the CEO pay is not for performance. It's really it's just a ripoff, and it's widely known that it's a ripoff. There was legislation proposed by Congressman Szabo, which would do again what you suggested, what he would do is tie that you couldn't get a subsidy, you couldn't get a tax write-off for any CEO pay that was higher than more than 25 times greater than the pay of the lowest worker within your firm. And so that was the gap that proposed in that Pay Equity Act legislation, where above that gap, you could not write it off. There's supposed to be a limit of about $1 million of a pay cap where you can't, supposed to not be able to write off CEO pay above that. But, of course, there are all these loopholes, and it says unless it's for performance, incentives, and all these kinds of things. And so that's how they justify it. But, of course, there have been just a number of studies showing that it is not for performance. On your point about minimum wage jobs being often very demanding, I think that's really, really important. And I referred to that somewhat earlier, that these are not just kind of jobs where you go do a little bit of work and kind of earn pin money, you know. But these are some of the most absolutely physically draining, demanding jobs in the country, which include jobs that are highly requiring an education. And so you have jobs ranging from, of course, farm labor, where people are doing the most kind of demanding, back-breaking work, earning very low wages. And you have child care workers, who are people who really often have a higher education, often are sacrificing tremendously economically to stay in the child care profession, because it is not treated like a profession. You have health care aides who sacrifice a lot to stay in that profession because they want to stay in the caring profession, but again, they're not paid like professionals. And of course, we have seen, we have seen now much more attention on the security workers at airports. You know, it's just an absurd situation where you have a category of security workers who have tremendous responsibilities. It should be a professional job, but who are paid so low wages. They're paid at minimum wage or some slightly higher than minimum wage, given no benefits. So it's not just that the wage is low, it's that they have no benefits, no paid vacation, no health insurance, anything like that. And they basically, because the job is so demanding and tiring, and also so low paid, the turnover is very great. And so every few months in some airports, the workforce turns over. And so you have workers who are not experienced, and then on top of that, they aren't trained. They're often put kind of on the front lines without training or with the most minimal training. And so we have these situations where, on the one hand, we are applauding the heroics of the New York Fire Department, as we should, and forgetting too often that this is a civil service, unionized job, treated like a profession. We're not counting on minimum wage workers who are given little training, who are turning over constantly, but we're saying this is a job, should be treated like a profession, it is, and many, many, many more jobs have to fall into that category. And whatever your job is, you have to at least make enough to be able to support yourself and your family.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. The magazine headlines you were mentioning earlier about CEO pay, one can sort of imagine, another headline saying minimum wage out of control or something.
That someone would say that minimum wage out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there has been actually, there's been pretty widespread support in a lot of sectors for raising the minimum wage, but there's a very strong lobby against it. there's a restaurant industry lobby, for example, that argues heavily against raising the minimum wage. Some businesses, by the way, are very much in favor of raising the minimum wage because they don't, they think it's very bad that they should be, you know, they're trying to do, pay their employees decently, they're trying to provide good quality services and products, and they feel forced to, they think of it as an unfair, you know, a disadvantage for them to have to compete with these kind of, with employers that are actually ripping off their workers. There are restaurant owners, I mean, for example, there's a chain, the fast food chain that ranks first among all the fast food chains in the nation in food quality value and in customer services, In-N-Out Burger, which isn't national. It's in California, Nevada, Arizona, and I believe a couple other states. And it pays its part-time workers even a starting wage of $8 an hour. So it knows that, you know, good wages are good business. Good wages can be good business. And many employers know this, and there have been all kinds of studies which show that, in fact, wage increases benefit businesses by improving productivity, by reducing turnover, and by increasing consumer purchasing power, which then can recycle back to the business.
We have another caller to bring into our conversation. Let's do that. This is a listener in Urbana online. Oop, I guess we lost them. We do have someone on a car phone, though, in Champaign. And I'm sorry I made that person from Urbana wait so long. If you'd like to call back, I'll try to get you in as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, someone on a car phone in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment, and then I'll hang up and listen to the response. I've always not been able to understand this labor theory of value. I don't understand why physical labor should be worth more than intellectual labor. We always talk about unpleasant jobs and physically strenuous jobs and how much they should be worth. And we assume that people who are managers and people who basically use their minds rather than their brawn for work somehow aren't earning the pay that they make. And the second point I want to make is simply that wages never have anything to do with intrinsic value. One could never, based on intrinsic value other than possibly the entertainment value, give athletes or Hollywood stars the amounts of money that we pay. Salaries are simply based on market forces. You're paid based upon what the alternative would be if you quit your job and went somewhere else. That's how we base university salaries. And I don't understand the whole concept of intrinsic value that should determine wages. I just thought I'd make that comment. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, a couple things. One is that salaries are not totally based on market forces. You know, when the CEO pay, there's some you know, wonderful quotes that I'm not going to remember offhand here, but the gist of it is, you know, CEOs, for example, corporate executives, want everybody else's salary supposedly based on market forces, but their own, they want it set by this kind of cozy insider boardroom committee, which is stacked by fellow CEOs and stacked with people that they themselves are close to, who are in this kind of win-win situation for themselves, where it's kind of like, you know, I'll vote for your salary to go up, knowing that, you know, you'll come and vote for my salary to go up when you're on my board, or, you know, you are, or our colleague will vote for our salaries to go up, and it's kind of this, you know, bizarre situation in which the salaries go up, and then they say, oh, well, the new average is this, and we can't possibly pay our CEO now under the average because that would, you know, assume that we, that would make it look like we didn't think our CEO was terrific, and then they raise that CEO. And, of course, you can't have a situation in which every CEO is trying to be paid higher than the average, or what happens is the average keeps going up and up, and that's what's going on. So there are no market forces setting CEO salaries. And, in fact, the problem is that they're able to write it off. I mean, why are taxpayers? That's not a market force. Taxpayers are subsidizing the growth in CEO pay, just like other shareholders and taxpayers are subsidizing the whole use of stock options. And so now CEOs are getting shoveled stock options in huge, enormous amounts, so that you have CEOs. There's nothing about market forces that is determining whether, you know, that the CEO Disney and other companies over the course of a couple years can be paid $500 million, or over the next few years, over $1 billion. You know, that's what it adds up to, all these stock options, where the minimum becomes in the millions, and then you talk about, well, you're only really well paid if you accumulate a treasure of $1 billion. It is so... it has grown so outrageously since even what it was just 10 years ago. And this is a totally stacked deck, not about market forces. The other thing is, we have had in the notion in this country that there are certain things that we don't entirely leave up to the market. And these are things like we don't leave the fact as to whether a company is going to dump toxic waste in a river or is going to make a product that will kill people. We try and say we have some regulations about that. We don't sort of wait until everybody kind of finds out about this product that's going to kill people, and then hopefully they won't buy the product, and that'll be some kind of exercise in market forces. But we have regulations there. And since the late 1930s, we have had a regulation as to what is the minimum you can pay an employee, with number of exceptions, but it's the minimum wage. And that minimum wage is not based on any notion of let's give everybody, you know, tons of money so that they can all kind of live like kings or something. It's based on what do people need to simply be able to meet their basic needs. Because what I'm always interested in people who are critics of the minimum wage, well, what are you suggesting here? If you pay somebody, if we allow it to continue where the minimum wage gets whittled away, you have people who literally can't make enough money on minimum wage, and there are always minimum wage workers. It is not like, you know, if magically everybody was able to afford to go to college tomorrow, and magically everybody gets into college and ends up with a college education, well, then you're going to have college-educated workers in larger numbers that are earning the minimum wage, that are in jobs which are not paid. And, I mean, in general, the most educated job, more highly educated jobs are paid higher wages. It's absolutely the case. I mean, physical labor tends to be devalued relative to jobs requiring college degree and above. But if magically everybody suddenly had a college degree,
you still need people.
You would have bottom rungs of college workers that would be paid very low wages to work at fast food restaurants and so forth.
Yeah. We have a couple callers, and let's go on next to a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Oh, yes, hello. I was discussing this issue with my father, and pointing out that since 1973 that real wages have gone down, and he responded by saying that, well, basically that was mainly due to the stagflation and inflation of the early 70s. Being a hardcore Limbo fan that he is, I'm assuming he was trying to blame Carter for everything. But nonetheless, I was wondering, is there any validity to that? And if there isn't, as I suspect, what's the best way to refute that argument?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, wages, if you look at over the whole period, wages went down a lot, and then there was a period in the 1990s, particularly at the end. It took all the way till almost the end of the 1990s till there was any significant catch-up in real wages, where actually wages were running somewhat ahead of the general inflation rate. But 73 is the peak year for your average worker's wages, and like I said, 1968 was a peak year for minimum wage. And in fact, there are a couple of things that come into that. I mean, you're adjusting these wages for inflation, so obviously when you're trying to make a comparison back to 1973, so obviously inflation's important. But if you look at, periods in history as to what happened to wages in previous economic expansions, the 1990s was a very, very miserly economic expansion. It was the longest one in our nation's history, but it was very miserly compared to, for example, expansion in the 60s, if you look at drops in poverty rate and if you look at growth in wages. So even at the end of the longest expansion in our nation's history, we did not catch up to the average wage of 1973. And the reason is not that there wasn't enough economic growth around to do that. not that it was such a huge gap to make up in terms of inflation. It's because the rewards of rising worker productivity and economic expansion were not fairly shared with workers, and they were not shared proportionally as they had been in the past. And so you had more going to the CEO at the top of the corporation. You had more going to the wealthiest stockholders. You had more going to the top 1% of households in the country. Between the 1970s and the 1990s, the mid-1990s, the top 1% of American households doubled their share of the nation's wealth. There was a much more inequality, a much more deepening of inequality between what people were paid at the lower end and in the middle compared to what people were paid at the top. And this isn't about market forces. In many respects, this is about political forces and about a different kind of economic force, because one of the things that went on in this whole period is we had a real decline in union membership. How many workers, what proportion of workers were represented in unions? And one of the things that went on in the 1980s, and I always point people to just go ahead and read back in Business Week and other of the business press, there was a real green light for union busting. And that's not some kind of rhetoric. I mean, many, many, many thousands of workers were fired for trying to exercise their right to organize unions. And unions, historically, there's a union premium. That is that union jobs tend to be much better paid and have better benefits. Last year, if you take the average, a union-paid job over the course of a year would pay you on average $8,000 more than a non-union job. So we're talking real money. And the difference was when we were in 1970, more than one out of four workers were in unions, were union members, and now it's about one out of seven workers. That's a real difference. And that's one of the reasons that employers were both able to get away with lowering wages and get away with keeping them low.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Our lines are all full, and we'll go on and talk with some more listeners. Let me mention that our guest during this hour, Focus 580, is Holly Sklar. She's a writer and commentator. You may have seen her column around newspapers around the country. And she's the author of several books, including one we're discussing this morning, Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us, recently published in paper by the Ms. Foundation for Women. We have several callers waiting, and we'll get on to our next listener in Chicago on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I want to bring something to your attention that you haven't hit upon yet. I don't know whether you're aware of it or not. Back in the 1950s, AT&T was considered the best-run corporation in America. Well, at that time, now, part of the basic ideology of the conservative, the laissez-faireist, is that in order to for a person to improve himself, he has to work hard and start at the bottom of the scale, and then as he progresses and gets better and better, his wages and salaries go up. Well, the reason I bring up AT&T being the best-run corporation in America back in the 50s is that at that time, the CEO then, the president of the corporation, made nine times what the lowest-paid worker in AT&T made, and which directly refutes the argument of the laissez-faireists and the conservative ideologues.
Well, Ms. Sklar, you have any comment on that?
I do. I mean, I think that that's a very, very good point, and that we have had, there are corporations today where the CEOs don't make as outrageous an amount that are good companies. We have nowhere else in the world do CEOs get paid as disproportionately compared to their workers as they do in the United States. And, in many countries it's 10 times, 20 times, maybe at the most 30 times. The gap is 30 times wider than the average worker. But your point is an important one, because we're not just looking at us compared to other countries. We're talking about, does this make sense in terms of our own history? And the reality is that you only have to go back to 1980 to see a time when our CEOs made 45 times the pay of average workers at major corporations. And you cannot say that, could anybody look at between 1980 and 2000 and say, well, the CEO is worth 10 times more, the worker is worth 10 times less. You know, it has nothing to do with that kind of a performance assessment. It has to do with what basically the CEOs were able to get away with in that period that they weren't able to get away with in earlier periods. And I started to talk earlier, and I just wanted to return to it, but what makes this situation even more outrageous is the way that taxpayers have to subsidize because of the way the laws are set up. The taxpayers end up doing two things, subsidizing the CEO outrageous pay by the way that the salaries are deducted from the income of the firm before they figure in the taxes. And then the other thing that goes on, and this is where I think it's interesting, where people talk about how, well, there shouldn't be a minimum wage, or it should be so low that people can't, you know, it doesn't matter how low it is, we shouldn't even worry about whether they can live on that or not. Well, if people literally can't buy food and housing and the things that they need minimally to live on, working a full-time job, then who's going to subsidize that? Then you're talking about charities subsidizing it through the donations of their congregation or of their donors or whatever, who are subsidizing through food banks. You're talking about other taxpayers subsidizing through the use of food stamps and various other things. So in the end, it's not some kind of pure market world where nobody is doing the subsidies. In fact, it makes more sense for people who really need the social safety net to get it, and business be expected to pay workers at least enough to meet their basic needs, and then, as was mentioned, to, of course, reward people for their rising productivity, for their experience, for their seniority, and all the things that go on, so that there, in fact, are, you can't expect that your wages are going to go up over time. But one of the things to remember is that there are many people who stick at low-wage jobs for significant numbers of years. This is not going in there, you work for, you know, 2 months at an entry-level job, and then boom, you're raised, and then boom, you're raised again, and ultimately you become a high management position. I mean, most people never get into those positions. We have a quarter of the workforce today making less than $8 an hour. A quarter of the workforce making less than $8 an hour. And by our accounting and raise the floor, you know, less than $8 an hour is not enough for even a single person on average in the country to, again, meet their minimum needs, including health insurance. Not saying, well, you know, you can meet some of your basic needs and you're just going to have to sacrifice the other one.
We have several callers waiting, and I want to also follow up about your point about the minimum needs budget and the way you describe that in the book. Hopefully we'll have time to do that and take these calls. But there's one question that I wanted to raise, and you know, in amongst these other changes in the past 20 years, one of those has been sort of changes in corporate practice, whereas a lot of functions were taken care of in-house. A lot of things are now contracted out and sort of external to the organization. And one of the things that's happened is contracting out to the lowest bidder. It's become a way of life and almost a necessity for CEOs and management to avoid stockholder charges of due diligence failures. There's real pressure to minimize costs, and that puts pressure downwards on wages.
Absolutely. I mean, the contracting out issue is a great point, because you not only have employers saying, you know, I need a new product or a new service, I'm going to contract out for it and then get the lowest bidder. And it's typically, you know, a firm that's hiring people. Let's say you're janitorial, you used to do an in-house janitorial service, and now you contract out. Well, typically it's going to be people who are making very minimum wage with no benefits. But you also have situations where there have been many, many firms where they literally turn their own workforce. So you'll have, say, their clerical workers or their own in-house cleaning staff or whatever it is, and they will, you know, one day, or their software, even their software folks, that one day they'll be there on the payroll, and then they'll be let go, and then they'll say, well, now we're going to be able to rehire you as a contract worker for this other supposedly independent firm.
Let me just interrupt for a second, because we have a weather warning that we need to pass on, actually a tornado watch, and this is something I need to get on the air right away, and then we'll continue, and I apologize for that. But the Storm Prediction Center has issued a tornado watch for portions of eastern and southern Illinois and most of Indiana, effective this Wednesday afternoon and evening until 7 o'clock. This is a particularly dangerous situation. Damaging tornadoes, Large hail to 3 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts of 80 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580, FM 90.9 severe weather coverage area, the tornado watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Ford, Iroquois, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, Cumberland, Clark, McLean, Livingston, DeWitt, Macon, Piatt, Moultrie, and Shelby. And the following counties in Indiana: Benton, Fountain, Park, Vermilion, Vigo, and Warren. Remember, a tornado watch means conditions are favorable for tornadoes and severe thunderstorms in and close to the watch area. Now is the time to think about what you would do should a tornado or severe thunderstorm rapidly approach. Also, keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions and stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest weather information and possible warnings. And repeating, a tornado watch is in effect for portions of eastern and southern Illinois and most of Indiana until 7 o'clock tonight. Well, we had to pass that on. Sorry to interrupt you mid-sentence there.
Don't be sorry. It's very important.
Right.
Good luck.
Right. Well, tell you what, we have about 6 minutes left, and I've got three callers. Let's see if we can include them in our conversation before we run out of time. And we'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering if your speaker would comment on the implications of the concentration of wealth on the recovery from the current economic, I think it's qualified as a recession now, hasn't it?
I think a lot of people are saying that it is a recession, or would be if we dared mention the word.
Well, and they're kind of waiting for the official,
right.
The kind of the standard recession, or the shorthand recession definition is two quarters of a drop in the gross domestic product. And so they haven't had they haven't had that officially yet, but almost everybody is saying they expect to when they really get to now look back and see the numbers. You know, typically you don't know, you can't say you're in a recession right away in the beginning, and you see it in retrospect.
So is the question basically what effect the recession might have on wages and
No.
Well,
the question was what effect of the concentration of wealth through the lower wages have on possibility of recovery.
Right. No, it's a very important point. I mean, nowadays, just to put it in perspective, the top 1% of households, which really grew, as I said, doubled their share of American wealth since the 1970s, went up tremendously. And the top 1% nearly has as much wealth as the bottom 95% of all Americans combined. And I often say to people, if you heard that about another country, wouldn't that strike you as something that shows that something's wrong there, if 1% has nearly as much wealth as the bottom 95%. But that's the reality in the country today. If you look at income, the top 1% has as much after-tax income as the 100 million Americans with the lowest income. And so it's a tremendous disproportion between the top 1% and the bottom. And so what are some of the problems with this? Well, one of the things that we saw in terms of the boom kind of ending and crashing in the way that it did was because so much of the investment ended up, or so much of the kind of extra dollars at the top ended up going into a huge speculative boom rather than toward the kind of productive uses that would have allowed the boom to continue in a more reasonable way for longer. And, of course, we also had the situation where the Federal Reserve made a huge mistake in raising interest rates. And one of the reasons that, you know, now they've been trying to make up for it terrifically by lowering, dramatically by lowering interest rates, but they haven't been able to undo the damage in any way. And one of the reasons they raised, or the main reason they raised those interest rates was in order to keep wages low, because they see higher wages as a threat to the growing economy, and so they intervened, and they ended up doing much more serious damage to the economy than in fact letting wages finally catch up to what they were in 1973. Now, in this situation, we have heard over and over and over again how consumer purchasing power is so important for the recovery. It's what was going to keep us out of recession. People were hoping until September 11th attacks happened, and then so much has happened since then that has added to the economic crisis that we were in before. So there was hope that consumer spending would keep us out of recession, and now there's hope that consumer spending will be able to recover and pull us out of the recession and get us back on the road to economic recovery. Well, we have a situation in which many people, in order to make ends meet over the last couple decades, have gone into tremendous debt. That's how they've made ends meet. And they're leveraged, you know, they're in debt up to their ears. And they can't take on more debt to make ends meet, they to spend more. Wages, not debt, is what should be at the heart of consumer spending, because most people, of course, whether they're living paycheck to paycheck or can save a little in between paychecks and so on, they're still their paycheck is what is at the heart of their consumer spending. So if consumer purchasing power is at the heart of economic recovery and wages are at the heart of consumer purchasing power, then clearly raising wages, better wages, are part of the solution, not part of the problem. And we had a situation, the last time we were in recession was at the start of the 1990s in 1991, and that was also when the minimum wage was raised during that last recession. You know, now we hear critics of minimum wage going up saying, well, you couldn't raise minimum wages during the boom because that was supposedly going to hurt the boom, which, of course, it didn't. Last time minimum wage went up, it was in the mid-1990s, and after that, the boom actually accelerated even more. We had historically low inflation, low employment, declining poverty, and so on, low unemployment, declining poverty, and so on. Now they're saying, well, you can't raise the minimum wage or you can't raise wages because that's going to hurt economic growth. But quite the contrary is the case. And we had during this recession in 1991, the minimum wage went up, and it was part of the solution. It had positive effects. It was one of the reasons we went from recession to a growing economy. And right now what the Congress is talking about doing, you know, with the economic stimulus package on the floor of the Congress now, the House talking about a stimulus package that's supposedly going to stimulate the economy by what? By mostly rewarding the wealthiest corporations and individuals and making things worse. In fact, we need to rebuild the economy in a way that actually brings us closer together and doesn't drive us further apart. That's really the solution, is strengthening low-income and minimum workers and strengthening average workers and making a stronger economy that's more cohesive and not pretending to depend, which is impossible, on just kind of more and more spending at the top. Because, in fact, you know, it's shown that at a certain point, people at the top are not rushing out and spending the money, you know, or if they're spending it, it's on luxury items. That's not what an economy can be built on, is, more money going into the pockets of people who will, you know, then rush out and buy another Jaguar or something. I mean, that is not what the economy is going to be built on or be recovered on.
I'm sorry to say that we're at the end of our time, and there's much more we could talk about and much more in the book than we've had a chance to really touch on. As always happens, we sort of scratch the surface on these things, and of course this is a very big topic. But I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to look for the book, the title is Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us. And the co-author, our guest, Holly Sklar, two other authors, Susan Wiffle, pronounce their names for me, would you? I'm sorry.
Larissa Makeda.
Okay.
And Susan Wiffle.
Okay. And it's published by the Ms. Foundation for Women. And also, you can get some information online about it. There's a website.
Yes, there is. It's www.raisethefloor, all one word, raisethefloor.org.
Okay. And an 800 number, is that?
We have an 800 number, 800-966-4486, 800-966-4486.
Okay, and if listeners didn't get that written down, you want to call me later. I'll make sure you get the information if you'd like to follow that up. And to you, Holly Sklar, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your tornado watch.
Thank you.